Blog Talk Radio.
So hello everyone and welcome to another episode of Sangoma, Stories from the Front Lines of Mediation. I'm your host, Batabi Lugumtumbani, and I'm a mediator and negotiator, and I am so happy and excited to welcome to the show today Lynn Knuken. She's my guest, and she's talking today about her life growing up in Ohio, and then also about her area of focus, which is crisis mediation and negotiation in crisis situations. So I'd like to say welcome to the show, Lynn. How are you?
I am just fine and delighted to be here. Thank you so much.
Well, you're welcome, and I'm really looking forward to a fun show. I wanted to have us get right to it and get started. You know, with the show, it's about stories, and I love to speak with people about their childhoods and explore how it is that how they grew up contributes to who they are today, especially as mediators and people who are interested in alternative dispute resolution. So tell me a little bit about where you grew up.
I was actually raised in Ohio in the Midwest. And when you asked me that question before, I wasn't sure how that influenced me. And now I am thinking of a couple of things. I had a very creative and active family life, and it was also somewhat stormy. I was the middle child. Traditionally, we're either the peacemakers or the troublemakers. I was actually both. So I did get some I got a lot of sensitivity to when people's moods were going to change. I think I developed a very high intuitive ability about what to watch out for. And my husband says it's a little spooky how I can read body language. So that was probably a key thing developing into becoming a mediator and a crisis intervener, something that I didn't know was a gift coming to me at that time. But being able to feel that for my own safety, I'd better darn well read body language, that was important. There was an incident when I was 14. Our family was driving to the East Coast for a vacation, and we were going up one of the mountainside passes there. It was a rainy day. From the opposite direction, a small pickup truck turned over on its side and began cartwheeling toward our car. And the last thing I remember was my father saying, "It's going to hit us." And when it did, the people from the pickup truck were tossed all over the road, and our family's doors were flung open. And what I did was go over to this very old woman with a scarf around her head and said, "You're going to be fine. I'm putting my coat over you. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that." And then I ran down and got help. And what I remember about that was when it was a real crisis and people were yelling and screaming and bleeding, I got very, very calm. Now, in routine situations like cleaning house and doing laundry and stuff, I'm not calm. I'm fidgety. But when there's a crisis, it's like having these little magnets on a glass tabletop and the magnet filings and then the magnet under the table. When there's a crisis, I get really, really calm and focused, and I feel right at home. And, in fact, a hostage negotiator asked me about that once. He said, "What kind of sadist or masochist are you that you love this field so much?" And I said, "Well, you know, how about you, except you get paid for it." And we all agreed that it was that feeling of being at home. That's the one place that kind of reaches our amygdala or something, and we feel great. Anyway,
I imagine that you feel really capable.
Yes, and focused, and we somehow, something clicks into my brain where I know exactly what to do. In a lot of areas of my life, I'm thinking, good grief, what now? But in a crisis like that, I know exactly what to do, and I can't tell you where it comes from. And there was another thing that I think I'd mentioned to you before, that my brother calls Ohio the land of no guile. So my background made it easy for me to be transparent with people. I kind of grew up in that, and that's created a lot of trust in the mediations I do. So.
Let me ask a little bit more about that and what you mean by the land without guile. You know, it's about more than just, you know, people tell the truth, they don't lie. It's also about a certain kind of, you know, it's about people not not shading the truth either, right? And having nefarious intentions and so forth.
I think you hit it. The intention is a real important part. We approach them without, and my husband is like this too, even though he's from Illinois. We approach people with the idea that let's just be simple and straightforward, and in my case, let's have fun together. But there's no, we just weren't surrounded by people with ulterior intent. It was very open and friendly. It's kind of a hi, y'all. I mean, there's a downside. There was someone who said, well, Ohio isn't the land where they eat Campbell's soup straight from the can, and they consider gravy a beverage. And I said, yep, sure is. But we don't, you know, in our area, we didn't take offense easily, and we just approach people kind of simple and straightforwardly. If it was somebody that we didn't think was good for us or we didn't like, we just didn't continue it. It was a pretty straightforward approach.
You also mentioned fun, and you said that you were surrounded by people who were profoundly creative and who were in love with life. Tell me more about that.
This is my family and their set of friends. There are five families all together, and they called themselves the Vicious Circle. They did things like go down to the Hocking Hills in southern Ohio. And southern Ohio has this amazing part of it that is like a cameo Grand Canyon, these huge cliffs and roaring little streams and waterfalls and just a lot of depth and shadow and wonderful mile-high boulders and stuff. So they would go on these vacations. One of them they went to was Pike Lake. And my father said, can you hear me okay? I hear static from this end.
Yes, I hear the static as well, but I'm hearing you. And
very good. And my father would do... There we go. My father would do things like saying, all right, we're all going to go out and try to find the dodo bird egg. And we'd scamper all over the place and finally find this big watermelon. He was an amazing man. He could read and speak ancient Greek and was fluent in German and played all the instruments. He was a kind of Renaissance man, as is my brother. He's a lobbyist for the environment and has created a state park in the Northwest. He saved the Cheat River. He's done amazing things. In fact, when we thought he was dying of cancer 10 years ago. Carole King wrote him a special CD just for him. Tribes Native American tribes prayed for him. Israel Kibbutzes prayed for him. He's an amazing man. He's committed his life and is a fascinating speaker. And all the people in that group were talented. They used to get together and have talent parties. Everybody would bring something they could do, whether it was showing the tango or baking a special set of cookies. And we were surrounded by harpsichord music, piano music, went to concerts, plays. It was just it was two things. It was always enthralling and exciting and beautiful and many times scary because of the amount of temper tantrums, mood switchings and stuff. So both of those gave me this tremendous joy in my life and this incredible sensitivity to who's feeling what. It's like, or what's going on at that exact moment. For instance, I was in a restaurant with friends once, and I said, I can tell you the relationship between any people that you choose in this restaurant. So my friends pointed out a couple. They were, it's a slightly older guy and a slightly younger guy sitting at a table. And I watched them for a while, and I said, it's a boss and an employee. It's a new employee, and they're in some kind of scientific business together. And they like each other. Okay, they're going to be all right. Well, no way of verifying that except to go up to their table. So we did, and we asked them to solve the bet, and I was right on. The scientific business was the pharmaceutical business, but it was exact. And it wasn't any magic. It was just watching the body signals. It was just, it was very, very plain.
Wow.
And it's unnerving sometimes for people, so I try not to say too much of it, but in my work, I found it extremely helpful. So, anyway.
I do want to ask you, I do want to ask you, you mentioned that there was this great joy and so forth, but then also with the temper tantrums and so forth, that you were feeling fear, and I'm curious about what you were afraid of.
I was afraid that I might get hit, although I didn't. I was afraid that someone would be, I was the middle kid, I had a younger sister, I was afraid that someone would shout at me, and that scared me to death. And because of that fear, I learned to watch early body language. For instance, my father, whom I loved dearly, would go and try to get the classical music on for all of our dinner time, for all our evening suppers. And there was a gentleman who came on the radio and said, and now is our evening, of our hour of classical music for between those afternoon hours and those of the evening to come. And it was such bullshit. However, we liked the music. So my dad would fiddle at it. And if it didn't go right, he would explode, get really, really angry. Every now and then he would just push his table back from the chair from the dinner table and say, "That's it." Once my little sister challenged him, he came to the table and he said, "This dinner is cold." And she said, she was about six, and she said, "Well, it wouldn't be if you hadn't come to the table so late." And he said, "That's it." And he pushed his chair back and it fell over and he stormed out of the house. So I didn't know what unexpected or angry thing might come up.
Right.
And I got very good at reading early signals.
I, you know, it's from thinking about how the family dynamics did add to your, you know, being watchful and what it is about your particular temperament that led you to be very concerned about, you know, watching body language and be concerned about keeping the peace and being concerned about your father exploding and so forth. And at the same time, you know, loving this really amazing man, as you said. Right. So it seems that then it allows you to have really complicated understandings of people. As you mentioned, you know, you're able to see somebody across the room at a restaurant and create a really detailed profile of who they are. I'm curious about whether this is something that develops or something that one is born with. I mean, I'd love to hear you say you can develop it because I want it.
I think you have it. I have read about you.
Oh, okay.
I do. Not to be so blunt and end the conversation, but I'm going to jump track for a minute and then come back to that. My specialty became, and I'll tell you more about this later, dealing with angry men. I had absolutely no fear and absolutely no problem. I mean, I had the ordinary fear, like, this guy's going to kill me and I'm not happy right now. But specialty became dealing with men in rage. And, I, you know, that's got to have had something to do with this father that I love so much and who was quite terrifying, never really terrifying to me. He didn't yell at me or hit me, but the storm around me, you know, for a small female was not good. So send me your question.
You quite anticipated the direction that I'm going in.
Oh,
gosh. I'm curious about how this experience that you have with your father has impacted this later work that you did. I found that really striking. But,
yeah, and I think that it came about by accident. When I was doing my first mediation, there was a group of, I think, like 14 or 15 angry neighbors, and there were two kind of defensive, rather frightened neighbors. They were from an apartment complex, and a kid had thrown something through a window, and that had been the latest of a series of misbehaviors. They had had it. They came at a very, very top of the spiral of conflict, right, and wanted to do something. And the first thing I noticed was there was 18 of them and two of the others. So I said, look, I'm betting you don't want to spend all night here. In fact, it was the World Series, and I did throw that in. In the interest of time, I'm wondering how you would feel about choosing two representatives from this group over here. I didn't want to say this side, but this group over here, and have the rest of you sit in back. And while you have these two and these two going through this problem, if you had questions or concerns, you might want to raise your hand, and we'll bring those in. And yes, that was fine with them. So we were going along very nicely in this mediation, and all of a sudden, one of those triggers came up in me, one of those feelings like something bad is about to happen. So while I was listening, I kind of scanned the room, and my gaze, as it were, lighted on this one man who hadn't said anything during the whole mediation, and everything in me said, there's trouble right there. So when someone was finished speaking, I said, you know, I have a question. Sir, I've been listening to people in the mediation. I noticed that most of the other people have spoken, but you haven't said anything. Is there something on your mind? Whammo! Exploded like a firecracker. Just on and on and on and on and on. And I listened in absolute silence. And then did the mediator thing, you know, as I understand it, this is what's got you this and this, and these things really need to be dealt with if you're going to feel any kind of peace in the solution. Am I right? Yeah, you're right. I really appreciate you bringing that up, because now we can put that on our list of things that we all want to work on together. So I totally forgot why I brought that in. Sorry. Anyone there? Hello?
A problem with the sound. Can you hear me now, Lynn?
I can hear you now.
Okay. So it sounds like
so where did we leave off?
Kind of went off. No, I've been listening, and it's been fine. I could hear you just fine.
Oh, good.
But I was curious about the identities of the people. I was wondering what was going on, because I wanted to ask you a question. So,
absolutely.
I was curious about you know, how the group was constituted. You said there were about 14 people, and then there were the two people. It sounds like the two people might have been the parents of the child who threw the rock.
Exactly.
Right, and I can imagine, of course, all the stuff that's going on with them. I mean, they want to live there, but all their neighbors are mad at them, but it's their child, and how complicated.
You got it. That's exactly the background they came in with. They wanted to live there. They wanted to live in peace. What was interesting later was once they got talking, you know, for a while, I made them talk through me, and after a while, I began to notice they were commenting on each other, so I let that come along. And then at the end, I said, okay, I'm going to write down your agreement. You see it on the wall here. Anytime you want to make changes, and I'll read it back to you, and so on. So I'm writing it down, and they're gibble-gabbling, they're yik-yakking, and I'm saying, you know, I'm having a little trouble concentrating. If you could just keep it down a little bit. Oh, yeah, definitely. Yap, giggle-gaggle. Finally said, you know, leave the room. I will call you back. And they came back, they're saying, oh, let me give you a ride home. And I think we all ought to have a big canoe and picnic party. And then the greatest compliment of all, the guy turned to me and he said, you know, we could have done this without you. We know what to do.
Oh.
And I thought, yes,
perfect.
You do. Good for you. And I did give them the usual warning about, huh? I'm sorry?
Well, yes, you gave them the usual warning about.
Yes, about, you know, if something comes and it gets too troublesome, you know, check back. We're always here for you. because
that's exactly what a mediator wants.
Yeah. Yeah, I want them to say you were pretty useless, actually.
Precisely. Oh, that's awesome. I also wanted to chime in on what was going on with that gentleman, the one who was quiet, because I have found in my practice, and I know I've spoken with other mediators about this as well, it's the ones who come into the mediation saying, I don't have anything to say. I have nothing to say. There's nothing I get, you know, or who are very quiet, who often turn out to be the ones who absolutely really need, you know, to get a whole bunch of stuff out. And I see that as a signal when they come in saying, I don't have anything to say. So it's wonderful that you picked up on that and came, you know, and brought him in a way that made him feel included, important, you know, significant.
Yeah, he was significant. And that's interesting. I've never heard anyone say, I don't have a word to say. That's something that I'm locking in to remember now. Yeah. Hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow, so that was your first experience as a mediator.
Right, and that was when I realized that what I enjoy is, well, I can't do landlord-tenant much too much because my math is just god-awful. I did a mediation demonstration once with a team, and we got to figuring out the rent, and finally I said to my team members, I don't know what we can get. When it's a really hot situation, then I feel perfectly. I can take it. I'm good.
Well, speaking of hot situations and being able to take it and so forth, you're great at these crisis moments, becoming really calm. But you're not a pushover either. And I don't know if it was your first job, but you got a pretty significant job based on the fact that you're also quite the advocate. Tell me about that.
Say a little bit more. You're talking about the first job with with the governor's office or where?
Yeah.
Or with that was a blast. That was such a blast. I was raising two kids alone, and of course, any single mother knows that when you raise two kids alone, you don't have any money, and every time they want something, the answer is no. Period. So I was driving to work in my little Ford Fiesta in the winter, and the heat didn't work, and I couldn't afford to get it fixed, and I was not generally in the best of moods. And don't I hear on the radio, the governor says, I'm going to lay all state employees back to 4 days a week. And I thought, what? I can't even make it on 5 days a week. So I did the adult mature thing. I put my head down, and I cried all the way to work. By the time I got to work... Huh? I was working at the EPA.
Oh, I see. Uh-huh.
The Environmental Protection Agency in Ohio.
Yeah, right.
And so I pulled in the parking lot, and by the time I got to the office, I was soaking wet and just livid. So I sat down and I wrote him this two-page letter on how he should be running the state. He wasn't doing it right, and if he was doing it right, we wouldn't have this situation, and so on and so forth. And then I wanted to give it to him. I was pretty sure if I mail it to him, I would get a letter back saying, you know, dear Ms. thank you for your letter. The governor really appreciates you, et cetera, and so forth. Yawn, sincerely yours. And it would be written by a junior intern and auto-penned. So, no. So I went over to the State House to give it to his executive secretary, who was a doll. And she said, I will be sure he gets this. And I thought to myself, not good enough. I said, no, thank you. And I tried a couple of other avenues, and what got it in was that one day I saw that there was being a wine and cheese reception for the First Lady over at the YWCA. So I got my little letter, and I put it in a big envelope so it would be noticeable, and licked it and sealed it shut, and went over to the YWCA. The reception started at 5. I got there at 4:30, and when nobody was looking, I slipped into the coat room, and I literally hid behind the coats and the coat racks.
No, you didn't.
Yes, I did. I'm a shameless person that way. So then when people started coming in, and I heard them heading toward the coat racks, I got out and fussed with a couple of the hangers, and I said, oh, what weather, huh? And then I walked out, took a glass of wine, walked around the room, and sat down on the couch, and pretty soon the First Lady and her aide came by, And I stood up right beside her and said, look, this is the suggestion that I have for you and the governor. If you wouldn't mind taking 5 minutes over a cup of coffee and reading it, and if you don't like it, line the cat box with it, and if you do like it, if you would give me a call. And she looked at me for a minute, and being the great person she was, she said, all right, I will. I said, thank you. And I put down my glass of wine and walked casually toward the door and ran down the stairs so fast. And when I got to the bottom of the stairs, I thought, just call me? That was the first lady. Oh, just call me? Okay, well, you did it, though. Which is one of the times I learned about risk-taking. It's really a good idea if you kind of think about it first, a calculated risk. So anyway, she did have one of her people call me. And they wanted, and here's another part, they wanted me to apply for a job at their office on their writing team. They
that
sent me all
is
the
incredible.
Paper. Isn't that weird? It was weird.
I don't think it's weird at all. I think, you know, it says something about the power of the letter that you wrote.
Well, I was pretty much into it. I must say that. I think I used the word wolf in it someplace, and I'm not sure what that was about. But anyway, they sent me an application, and one of the things was I had to write letters in several different voices, because one of the things I would have been doing would be writing columns for iron workers, for seniors, for all different kinds of constituents. And I thought, oh, my, wrote a couple, and I thought, this is a big yawn. So I threw it in the fireplace. I thought, the hell with it. And at that moment, and this is another turning point, my sister-in-law from Washington called me, and I adore her. She's just the most wonderful person. And she said, how you doing? I said, I'm fine. How you doing? And she said, what are you doing? And I said, well, I just got this application from the governor's office. It's really boring. It's not worth it. And then Rachel said, and if Rachel ever calls you and asks you this question, if she says, may I ask you a question, say no. No, Rachel, you cannot ask me a question because it's going to change your life. She said, can I ask you a question? And me, naive, you know, from Ohio, she said, yeah, sure, ask me a question. She said, would this look good on your resume? Oh. So I went and I got it out of the fireplace, and I dusted it off, and I sent it in. Well, about 3 or 4 weeks later, they called, and I was at the EPA, and it was another bad day. The computer wasn't working. I kept walking into things. I don't know what it was. And the phone rang, and I picked up the phone and picked it up the wrong way, and the phone itself fell off the desk onto my foot. And then I grabbed for the phone itself, picked it up, said hello into the wrong end. And by the time I got to the right end, I had had it. And I said, who is this and what do you want? And a voice said, this is the governor's office, and we would like you to come for an interview. And I thought, damn it. So I said, okay, you've heard me at my worst. If you still want me to come, I will.
Yay, it's a great sign.
And so I did. And so I got the job. So that was another. And the thing that's coming across to me when I'm talking to you about this has been what I used to call a career ladder with no rungs. You know, from a degree in Victorian literature to realizing when I was 14 at that accident, I had this weird gift, to realizing that the kind of combination of love and terror developed this quality. Weird stuff, you know? So,
love this combination of love and terror.
Yeah.
Statement.
It's really something. It was a friend of mine when something bad had happened, and she looked at me and she said, and what gift did this dark angel bring?
Huh.
And I was thinking about that. We were talking just now that living in a family that was both wonderful and terrible, it was like a gift brought by a dark angel. There was a gift in it. And sometimes it takes years to realize that, but there
right.
is.
Right.
So.
And look, and it sounds though that you were able to realize it and use it early on.
Yes. That was another gift, that I was able to use it. I love your questions.
Oh, great. Thank
I'm having such a good time with these. I really am.
Well, I figured we'd have a good time. I mean, your story is so compelling. You start working for the governor's office, and as you said, you were asked to do different pieces of writing, and then there comes a time where you are writing in behalf or on behalf of a governor's peace initiative.
Yes, it's, you know, politicians like to have initiatives. There's everybody's going to have a job, or there's a chicken in every pot, or this is going to happen during the next 4 years. This is my legacy. This is how you can define me. Well, God rest him. His legacy was the peace initiative, to make this step toward peace in the community and then maybe ripple out toward who knows. And
well, I have to really ask, Lynn, before you get into that, what year was this?
It started in about 85 and ended about 91. And 89 was when he created the Ohio Commission on Peace and Dispute Resolution.
Because he sounds so far ahead of his time.
Oh, he was. We had to do all kinds of machinations to get that bill through the legislature, including at midnight and as a writer on a Republican bill.
Oh, goodness.
He was one of the people who's not only good but smart. You know, a lot of Democrats are really nice people, but they ain't going nowhere. They ain't helping anybody. But this was Celeste, and he was really canny and really excellent and really far ahead of his time. He got peace. He got mediation in the courts, communities, schools. It was intense. First of its kind in the nation.
And this was back in the 80s and early 90s?
Yeah, late 80s, early 90s. Mm-hmm. It was.
Marvelous, marvelous. But this is how you got involved.
Well, it was. He had he asked me to write the speech, and as I told you, I said the American Bar Association and the Ohio Commission were sponsoring a mediation training. I thought, boy, does this sound interesting. So I said, he said, I want you to write the speech. And I said, if I write the speech, can I take the training? And he said, don't bargain with me. I'm the governor. And I said, you're right. But I got to do it anyway. And two things happened. I got in trouble with both of them. One is when you write a speech for him, you can write it out, but then you also give him talking points on little cards so he can refer to it quickly.
Yes.
And the standard is about maybe 8 is good, 10. I wrote 22 pages. And what he does is he memorizes the reminder talking points on his way to wherever he's going. And the aide said that as he got to the 14th and 15th card there, his face was kind of turning red and then purple, as it were. And he was really mad. So when he came back, he called me into his office, and you don't want that.
Mm-hmm.
He said, don't you ever do that to me again. Don't you ever write anything as long as that. And I said, well, I got carried away. He said, I didn't ask for your answer. I'm just telling you, don't ever do that again. And I said, yes, sir. And he said, that being said, that was the best speech I could have imagined on that subject. So then I felt good. But
that sounds a little bit like he might have had echoes of your father.
You got it. And you should get a double degree in psychology. I'm absolutely serious. Same kind of charm. And I've noticed that people in office often do. They're under stress and things have to be perfect. They do. They can't mess up, because when they mess up in front of thousands. So you better not be the one that made them do that.
Yeah.
Anyway, I didn't think that worked out. But the other problem was that since I also did work for the press office, I went and got the newspaper, it was Ohio's largest newspaper, to come and cover the training, because I thought I'd have a lot of publicity. Well, they sure did. They sat down at my table, where I was just learning, mind you, and I said to one of the disputants, why don't you take a big breath and just calm down, which is something, of course, I'd never say now. And she looked at me and she said, why don't you take a big breath and calm down? And I just fell apart. Oh, God. And they wrote up that little gaffe because it was so cute, right? And my mother read about it in the paper, and she said, "Can't you do anything right, Lenny?" So those two things were my jumping-off point for mediation. But, and that's another thing I want to tell people, too. You know, if you're going into something and you love it, take the hit. You'll get through it. You'll be fine. I remember this for the rest of my life. I'm still walking and talking.
Well,
take
you know,
the
what,
risk.
What came
take
to my
hit.
Mind... But what came to my mind was, where could you go but up?
That's true. I was on the floor, yes. Exactly. And I've had many a moment like that, and you're right. It's perfect. And, I can only go up from here. It must be good.
There you
yes.
go.
Yeah.
So
you
got into this. It's your passion, as you've described it. And you were able to over time, craft a path or you know, you walked a path, I suppose, into a focus that really speaks to your deepest skills.
Somehow, yes, and that was another interesting thing. It was 2 months before the governor's final term. He could only have had 2 terms. And 2 months before he was due to go out of office, it was in November, I was still too scared to look for another job. I was in my 40s, and I thought nobody would hire me, and et cetera, and so forth. And 2 kids depending on me, and I was just paralyzed. And then one of the secretaries came up to me with a little teeny cutout in the classifieds saying, looking for associate director for a mediation center in a law school. So I applied for that, and... They had 3 different interviews, and I was annoyed at being called back 3 times. I thought, if you don't know what I'm about now, forget it. I got all snitty about it. And a friend of mine said, so are you going back for the 3rd interview? And I said, no. And he said, well, if you don't, I'm going to put on your little red suit and your little black patent leather shoes and pretend I'm you, and I will go back for it. And I said, for God's sake. So I did. But one thing that was, before I started in there, I just wanted to tell you about was that once I discovered the power of mediation, when I began volunteering, I came home, I was after my first mediation, I was high, I could hardly breathe, and I thought, this is the answer to the world's problems, this is a panacea, this is the answer to everything, and it's right here in my hands. So I went home to... my 11-year-old daughter, and she hadn't cleaned up her room yet. And I said, Julie, your room isn't clean. Well, I've been tired, and I this and I that. And I said, well, you know, you sound like you really are tired, and you don't want to, you know, this is the last thing you want to do. And she said, don't talk mediator, talk to me.
Oh, no.
And I said, all right, get in there and clean up your room. And she said, well, I thought you were the big mediator. And she went out and slammed the door, and I had my head in my hands. And I thought, perhaps it doesn't work everywhere.
No. Well, I don't know what other mediators might say about this, but I do get the same thing from my family as well. You know, I'll be talking, and all of a sudden they'll get quiet, and they'll look at me. They're like, are you doing that mediator thing?
Yes, exactly. I've tried it on my friends. Once it worked. Not very often.
Well, okay.
So I began, when I took this job as the associate director, I worked with 2 amazing people in Columbus, Scott Dewhurst and Roberta Mitchell. They were very, very classy, very skilled mediators, and I learned a great deal from being with them. And then I got married and moved to Canada. And this was another one of those things where, like being on the right corner when the bus comes, I was sick and tired of unpacking boxes. I had it. It was mid-July. Of all times, there was a heat wave in Canada. So I began leafing through the phone book to see if they have any mediation centers. Well, it turns out they did, and it turned out that the person who was manning the phones was the director because the secretary was out at lunch. And I said, I'm a mediator from Ohio. I'm calling to find out about here, about what's hot, what's not. And we talked for a little bit, and she said, you sound interesting. Let's have lunch. And I thought, oh, well, she thinks I'm interesting. I want to have lunch with her. So we did. And she said, I'd like to see your resume. And I had met with her again one time and brought it. And she says, too bad you haven't published anything. And I said, oh, I have. I forgot to put it on there. And look, she took a look at stuff, and she said, I've got a $500,000 grant to do a mediation study on working with, right, with coaching men or assessing men with a history of rage and violence to see if they're appropriate for mediation. In the city of London, Ontario, at that time, it was not even considered. You do not even think about that. So she was quite a forward-looking person again. She said, would you be willing to do the assessments? And I said, yeah, sure, you're kidding. So they put me up in a little tiny room on the third floor above the courtroom, and they would send in these violent men so I could talk to them and see if they were suitable. And that's when I realized that this gift for, you know, sensing what to do about sudden violence really came to the fore. And that's how I started looking for things in the field as I went from place to place. So,
well, I'm curious to know what criteria you came up with that would allow one to say yes, this one, or no, that one.
Yes. No history of anything in the previous 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing like murder. Not good. Full consent of the partner, like nothing like, well, I guess so, okay, or maybe. No contact between the parties. As soon as the idea of mediation was agreed on, no contact between the parties before, after, or during, and after only under monitoring. And the assessment sheet that I had, I forget what there were. There were 50 or 80 questions that let me know. It's hard to tell you what it was, but I got a very good sense of whether he was telling the truth or whether he was more edgy than he thought he was, and so on. And then it was how they were with me. I had a guy who came in once, and he looked like Tom Selleck, only like a foot taller. And
oh,
he stood in the doorway, and then he marched in and slammed the door so hard that the door went open and shut about six times, blam, 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 blam. And he said, the judge made said I had to be here. And without a pause, I just rose from my chair, kind of floated over to him, offered him my hand, said, you know, I'm Lynn Knuchen. I'm so glad to meet you. I apologize for that door. We've never been able to get it fixed properly. Have a chair. Pulled out a chair, and the whole thing was so fluid that he was sitting down. And for a moment, I deliberately stood over him and said, I hope you had no trouble finding the place. But the message was, you're sitting down. I'm standing up. And the door thing that you just did is not even going to be considered because we're going to say that you didn't do it. So you don't have that threat handle over me. And as after he'd been talking, we talked for about 2 hours, I knew that he was going to be okay. And I can't quite explain why. Maybe if there's a different one, let me try that. It was a prison guard. And one of the things that he did would come right up to my face, maybe an inch from it, which was very threatening for me.
Of course.
And start talking, and I thought, if I move forward into his face, it's going to cause him to lose face. If I back up, it's over. He knows he's got me. So I stayed perfectly still, feeling like an absolute fool. Your little nose is almost touching. And decided to do the blah, blah, blah thing. Oh, well, perhaps you don't know about the mediation thing. I know the judge doesn't often explain it, and here's the assessment sheet. And if you have any problems on it, like I'll give you an example, just running a blah, blah, blah so that he could kind of run his computer scan over me. and decide whether I was trustworthy, to realize that in this kind of embarrassing situation, I wasn't going anywhere, but I wasn't going to threaten him, and hoping that the blah, blah, blah chatter was going to make him feel at ease enough that he could back off. And he
did.
That's
such an important thing that you've done there, Lynn, is that, you know, rather than allowing yourself to get that heightened sense of being threatened yourself, that rather you are empathizing with him and with what it informs his behavior.
Yeah, that's interesting. It was. I realized when you're talking about it that my concern was for him. I was scared, but I wasn't scared as much as I was thinking about what's going on with this guy. And it's funny. I've done a lot of reading and research on hostage negotiation and crisis negotiation. And they say that mediators can actually become so attached, or the negotiators become so attached, that the secondary negotiator has to hang on to that negotiator's belt and keep them from going over there toward them. It's just, it's an interesting thing that happens. So
a deep bond there in that moment of crisis, right?
It is. It is a very deep bond. It's very. There was a guy that called on the phone, and he was really angry because he made a whole lot of money and his ex-wife didn't. And he said, nobody will give me an answer. I don't know what the hell is going on, but I don't know why she shouldn't pay exactly what I do. And he was all over the board and yelling and screaming. And he paused and he said, I said, you know, I'm going to look this up for you. And he said, you probably think I'm some kind of fruitcake yelling around like this. I said, you sound like a man who's really frustrated because you haven't been able to get any answers. I don't know the answer, but I will call you back in 10 minutes. Let's see where we are. And that's all it took. And the thing that I'm hooked on is the transformation.
Yeah.
Like, oh, thank you very much. I think maybe if I got psychological, that's what I was always looking for. So, anyway, one of the fun things...
I wanted to comment on that moment because you said you got hooked on the transformation. And one of the things I am enjoying about talking with mediators and you know, getting so many different stories and compiling them is that thing, you know, hearing from other people what I've experienced, which is that moment where something happens and you're hooked on that moment. It's sort of like your first high and you're always looking to experience that high again.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly it. It's really bad if you don't have somebody to talk about after a mediation.
Yeah.
You just are high. And it's watching that change. It's watching that change.
Yeah.
It's and everybody I've talked to has been like that.
Right.
One thing that happened after, this was a mediation team I was working with. They were all being paid by this grant, and I was the assessor. I would decide whether they went into mediation with this team or not. And the most, the thing that made me feel best about what I was doing for my work was when we had a team meeting, and the team said, these guys, they were pretty big bruisers, you know, and they weren't gentle little lambies a lot. And the mediator said, it's amazing. These men are talking like Lynn. They're saying things like, I notice my knuckles are getting a little white and my breathing is getting rapid. I need to take a break and gather my thoughts. And it was just the cutest thing. I thought, God love you guys. Because when I went through the coaching, for instance, if they would frown or slap the table or something, I wouldn't say anything about it at the time. But later on I would say, you know, when you frown and slap the table like that, I got scared. Has anybody else ever felt that way, do you know, when you did that? And so we would go through this back and forth, and they'd start talking, well, yeah, they have. Well, what are you trying to say to them? Well, you know, I want them to not walk out on me because that's disrespect. Okay, so respect is the same thing you're after. That sounds really good to me. Let's work, and so on. You know, I mean, you know the drill. But it was just lovely to know that they were doing that. So then I did start to...
Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead. I was just going to say, so so then we moved to Virginia. My husband was kind of going up a career ladder of his own, and I was trotting around after him, happily so, because you can take this anywhere, right?
Sure.
Even to Occupy Wall Street, yes.
Aha!
So, aha! So I was unpacking again, right, and tired of it. I flipped on the TV, and lo and behold, there was a hostage negotiation documentary. They had a trailer set up with a throw phone, and the subject was in another house, and he was a yelling and a screaming. And I heard the mediator starting, his voice was starting to pick up the pace a little bit, or the negotiator. It was getting a little bit more high-pitched, and all my alarms went off, and I thought, uh-oh, this guy is just about to get into a tangle with the subject. They'd better replace him, and they'd better replace him with a woman. Right after that, the on-scene commander came in and said, Danny, you're doing a great job. Why don't you take a break for a while? I'm going to bring Janine in here. And boom, and it went fine.
Amazing.
And then at the end, the guy was ready to surrender, and I thought, you know what? He's really going to need somebody to go up there and be with him and assure him it's going to be done with dignity. He's not going to be roughed up or humiliated. And lo and behold, that's exactly what they did. And I thought, I get this stuff. I'd love to do this. And I thought, how can I get the training? And then I thought, probably the best trainers are the FBI. So why didn't I just call them? And it was almost like that thing I gave to the first lady. Sure, Lynn, why don't you just call them and ask them to be your trainer? You got your degree in Victorian literature. You go ahead and call them.
I sense a pattern.
Yes, you do. You do. So I called Quantico, and here was another humiliation. The operator said, she answered, says, it's Quantico, Virginia. I said, I'd like to speak to your training director. And she said, ma'am, the whole place is a training place. I'd like to speak to the FBI. And she said, all right. And it was almost like the one in Canada. Everybody was at lunch except the director of the critical incident group.
Wow. Wow.
And we got to talking, and it's amazing to me, and I've always seen this, how if the palace guard is not there and you're talking directly to that person, how generous they are and how willing to mentor. He sent me his notes in his text that he had underlined. He offered to mentor me. It was just, I was blown away. I was ready before I called. I thought, okay, Lynn, you need to get 50 rejection letters before you really think you've started here, okay? That's what you're aiming for. And as luck would have it, it hit the right person at the right time.
Wow.
Through a series of kind of benign accidents, I got admitted to a couple of their trainings, hostage negotiation and crisis negotiation, really crisis negotiation trainings. And one of them made me feel, again, so good about myself. It was a 5-day training, and toward the end they had to put us through our paces. And my negotiation was with a subject in another room. He was a professional actor, and he was being, excuse me just a moment. Oh, was this home? Okay, yeah. He was a guy in a pizza parlor, I believe, waving a gun. He's going to kill his girlfriend and the pizza guy and whatever. I don't know if they didn't have pepperoni or what the problem was, but it got out to be way out of hand. And I was assigned to negotiate that from the next room using this elaborate package of throw phone mechanisms and on-off buttons and so on. So we got to negotiating, and it was fairly short. When it was finished, I did talk him down. He came into the room, and he said, which one is Lynn? And I thought, she's not here. Got to go to the bathroom. Goodbye. And I raised my hand. I said, I'm Lynn. And he said, you were so good that I had trouble staying in character. Wow. So ever since then, I became hooked on that. I couldn't go be a crisis negotiator because I'm not law enforcement. But I could do research in it, and I could do things in the field that weren't actually barricade situations. In my next life, I want to come back in that. But anyway, so that became my real passion.
Well, I'm curious about that, though. What reason is there for not actually going in and being trained in law enforcement?
I'm 71, and that'll do it every time. I think their cutoff age is 35.
What?
Yeah, I think so.
Wow.
So anyway,
because everybody knows I'm 27. And
I'm
a very experienced 27-year-old.
Yes, I've
been 27 for a number of years now.
I believe you. I believe you.
Well, you know, I think it's important for people to know these things, that there are these cutoff ages.
Yeah, but if they want to go into law enforcement, and they want to, this is the most wonderful, I was going to call it the sweetest profession, that really sounds, I'm not sure they'd appreciate that, but it's called law enforcement's most powerful non-lethal weapon. They change people's lives. And funny thing happened. There was a guy who was in a house holding somebody hostage in a house at night, and they went in and he wouldn't answer to them, and they threw a throw phone in the house and he wouldn't answer that, and they kept calling and yelling, and after about a half an hour they heard a voice two houses down and said, "You're in the wrong house, I'm over here."
No way.
How good was that? There was a case where there's a jumper on a bridge, and it stalled traffic for hours. It was 5 o'clock traffic. It was just awful. And finally, the negotiator, they had established a bond already. And the negotiator said to the guy, "At least, you know, give us the keys to your car, because we can't get anybody through here, and it's going to cost us." The guy came down, handed him the keys. They got him. And the situation ended. That brought me to an interesting thing. I talked with the head of the Scotland Yard negotiation team, and she said, "You know, Lynn, in England it's very different. If we back traffic up for several days, that's too bad. They'll have to take care of themselves. We are solely concerned with getting that person out of trouble." Now, here there's all kinds of media attention. You know, at Waco, at the Freeman Stage in Montana, it was 81 days, the newspapers said that was too long. The Waco siege, they said that was too short. You got police departments with a shortage of manpower, and the city has to pay for all this. So there's all kinds of pressures. There's pressures from the SWAT team versus the negotiation team.
You just
want to
go in and get it over.
Yeah, get it done, man. He done wrong. Let's get him out of there. We can do this. And they can. They can. But the negotiators are so, I mean, you've got these guys with guns, with power, and you see them sitting there saying, "So, hey, buddy, yeah, I've been in that situation myself, you know." And one thing I learned from this marvelous man, Mitch Hammer, he helped discover the Unabomber. He's real good at analysis of dialogue in hostage negotiations. And he wrote something called the SAFE method, S period, A period, F period, E period. And the thesis is, and it's known by other negotiators, but the way he put it was really good. He said, don't solve the problem. Do not get in there and solve the problem. Another negotiator, Greg Vecchi, said, get inside their head and wander around. Make the connection.
I'm so sorry. Let me say this really quickly. We're actually coming down to the time of broadcasting. It's going to go into recording. If anybody's listening, just stay on. And after the show is done, after we're done, we're going to have a full recording so they can hear the rest of the conversation that way. It may go off the air for folks who are listening, but don't worry about it. You can come back and hear the rest. We're going to ask Lynn about preventing schools shootings in schools. So we want you to stick around after that. So, Lynn, yes, go ahead. You were talking about not solving the problem. I think that's so important, you know, empowering the person so that they're the ones who are solving the problem. And then also, you know, like you said, wandering around in their head. Tell me a little bit more about that.
There was an example that Mitch gave in his text that a negotiator was working with a subject and they were getting along just fine. So the negotiator began making suggestions for the problem. And the subject said, "What the hell are you talking about?" And they lost the connection for a while. It was just a good example. If you get in their heads and think like they're thinking, and then, as you say, you empower them. You did that at Occupy Wall Street. I read about how you got in and how you made it clear that they had your full support and all the intelligence and skill at their disposal. It's exactly the same thing. There is a wonderful book that I'm going to jump track again, but I want to recommend by a man named Douglas Steere, S-T-E-E-R-E. I don't remember the title, but it's about listening as a sacred act. And that the speaker knows if the listener is fully with him, and the listener knows too. And it's a book that kind of opened me up anyway. It was an amazing book.
Well, Lynn, it's awesome that you mentioned that. You know, the title of this show is Sangoma.
I know what that means.
Right, there you go. So yes, and I absolutely see what mediators do as being you know, that kind of responsibility for the health and well-being of a community that, in the context of a Sangoma, is seen as a sacred trust.
Say more about that, because I know what it means, but I don't know that everybody does. And it's really a powerful thing. So say more.
You know, a Sangoma is a combination of natural healer and psychotherapist and all of those things in the Southern African traditions and so forth. I'll say Nguni, which encapsulates Zulus and Xhosas and Swazis and Ndebeles in South Africa. And there are two different kinds of practitioners, if you will. There are Nyangas and there are Sangomas. Nyangas focus on medicine. It's herbal medicine, you know, they do that. A Sangoma is going to deal not only with the physical manifestations of the illness, but the spiritual manifestations and the spiritual causes of the illness as well. So they're going to look at the individual, they're going to look at the community, you know, and illness is seen as a community issue.
Yes, and that they bring to the community, the physical community, it's a spiritual sacred responsibility to heal social ills. I thought that is wonderful.
Yes, absolutely.
And that seemed to be what you and your partner were doing, the woman who was with you at that time.
Yes,
that's what caught my attention.
She is marvelous. She is so marvelous because she does come at it from that perspective. I mean, you know, there are many people who are wonderful nonviolent communication practitioners, you know, who have the training and so forth. But there was something about Tashi that she and I just really clicked, because I think we absolutely shared that in common, that absolute caring, that empathy, you know, that empathy that you're talking about, you know, with the men who were coming in because of rage issues, or, you know, somebody who's taken somebody else hostage. I mean, talk about frightening. I think people don't really think about the hostage taker as being more frightened than anybody else. That's really scary.
You put your finger on it. It was, it was back in the 70s that the FBI, and I think there are people over in England doing this too, realized that hostage takers, now there are hostage takers saying, I want you to free prisoners in this and such nation, and I want a plane, and that's that. That's a little different. They're willing to die for it. But so they said most situations are crisis negotiations where the person is having emotional trouble. Something's hit them and pushed them over the limit, whether they got caught in a bank robbery, whatever. It's still is still a crisis in their head. They talk a lot about the amygdala. I've learned to love the amygdala.
Emotional intelligence, right?
Yeah, pretty much, when you can calm it down. They say when it gets, the reason you can't say to someone, calm down, is because when the amygdala gets going, it's literally flooded physiologically.
Yes.
You cannot calm down. That's why you have to talk and talk and talk, and then the whole nervous system, the whole blood flow backs down, then you can. Anyway, there's this wonderful, the commanding officer of the hostage negotiation team in New York City, and he talks a lot about negotiating with the mentally ill, and he says, and I never forgot this, you have to really care about them, and they have to know it. And I thought, wow, you have to really care. He said, they throw spears at you, let the spear pass through you, but you have to really care, and they got to know it. Oh, that's just absolutely wonderful. Another one, there are all kinds of tricks I learned from these people. It's just, that's been very, very good stuff. The thing I think that impressed me the most is that the crisis negotiation is, it's an exquisite art, but it's a very tough science. You train in the rules, and you train, and you train. And then you go out and act completely natural and present and open like there were no rules or anything. How do these people do that? I just totally admire them. So,
yes, people, it sounds like you've carried that work forward, and now you're doing some work in preventing shootings in schools, especially in the wake of what happened in Aurora. I think that work is really interesting, and so necessary. Tell me more about that.
I got an article from a hostage negotiator named Dwayne Fuselier, who was at every negotiation major incident in the United States. And after Columbine, he was a lead investigator there. He devoted the next years to reading and researching and writing on it. He wrote an article about how to teach parents to prevent school shootings, and they can, parents and teachers, but really parents. He sent this to me and said, can you help me get the word out? So I published it in our online crisis intervention newsletter, and then he and his co-author thought it'd be great to do it at the conference coming up. So we set up a day-long conference, and what I'm trying to do is get parents, I think we're the only session that is doing this not for professionals, but trying to get people from the community in. I want to get the parents in the New Orleans schools into the session. An FBI hostage negotiator, Greg Becky, is going to be teaching it.
This is the ACR conference in New Orleans that's coming up. Is it in September?
Yes, yes. And this session is arranged especially on a Saturday, so principals can come, teachers can come, and parents can come. And the parents don't have to pay anything. I just want them there.
Yeah.
And so not being in New Orleans, I'm racking my brains and drinking a lot of coffee thinking, how can I get the word out in New Orleans? I've called newspapers, I've called ministers, I've called school board people. The amount of return calls I'm getting is absolutely amazing. It's like zero. So I have to keep calling. But I'm willing, I went after the FBI and I went after, the governor's office. So I'm thinking, why not go after this? Probably the reason I'm 71 and have no more, energy left, but I'm going to try it, make one last try at it. I want to get in there. The thing about the school shooting.
Well, I'm really surprised. I mean, talk about, being straightforward about things. I'm going to say this straightforward. Again, Aurora, I mean, I know it didn't happen. Talking about a mass shooting, I don't know so much about profiling, but I'm certain that there is something to be said about the similarities between the shooter in this situation and what happens in schools. It just happened to be in a theater. Why wouldn't people be tearing down the doors, knocking down the doors to come in?
Because it can't happen here. And it's true. It's rare, but the thing is, if it happens once, it happens forever. You will never ever get away from it. You will never get away from it. So anyway, yeah, the FBI is a little bit shy of some profiling. They say there are no real profiles. But what they're trying to get at is that the school shootings are different from any other kind of school violence because it is very carefully planned over a period of a couple of days or a year. And during that time, the key word is leakage. Somehow, intentionally or unintentionally, the shooter lets his plans known to somebody or someone somehow. And the kid, and here's the second part. The kids know, but they won't talk. I don't want to be a snitch. I'm afraid if I talk to an adult, they'll go berserk and I'll get, you know, laughed out of school or I'll cause something worse. They don't talk. So this is a training that shows parents how to get kids to talk, and it's the same way hostage negotiators get their subjects to talk. And that if parents can develop this kind of mentoring, a switch into mentoring relationship with good listening, with supportive listening, with respect, and with the assurance to the kid, look, I'm not going to go sky high. You and I are going to settle down and think what's really the best thing to do. Then 80% of the time, they can know when something's coming down. That's an astounding statistic.
Right.
So that's what we're after. That's what we want the training to be about, and that's why I want to get go down there and get people into that training. So.
Well, you know, I am so hoping that that it is successful and that it goes forward, because I can't think of anything that is more, well, I mean, maybe it's a little bit of hyperbole to say I can't think of anything that is more important, but it is so, so very important. I will do whatever I can, you know, to put the word out so that folks can know about this and perhaps, you know, get in.
Thank
and
you.
Take a few hours to listen to this.
Oh.
It can't hurt.
You know what? If anybody, you can find a way about anybody who knows anyone in New Orleans.
Well,
that would be helpful. Say again.
So, there's Facebook, and yes, I absolutely do know some folks in New Orleans. So, you know, we'll put the word out because
It's
just me. I don't think that I'm that unique in thinking if you were making this available here, I would definitely be wanting to go to that, and I think I know a number of people at least who would want to. So, you know, kudos to you for putting this out there. It's such important information. And you're right, you know, as you were saying, somebody always knows.
Yeah, there's always somebody who has an aunt in Wichita who knows a kid that lives down in Louisiana whose uncle knows this, and then boom. There's going to be somebody. That's how you get the links to it. But yeah, in the school shooting itself, they know.
They know.
Right. And they won't.
I'm so sorry. Go ahead.
That's all right. No, we're good. That's all I needed. So anyway, I'm just hoping I have some Quakers there who have given me some references. Maybe I could send something out on that Maria's listserv, asking if they know anybody.
Sure.
The 1,000 people.
Well, it would be my pleasure to help in any way.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Very welcome. We're actually, we've run out of time. We're getting down to a point where my recording is going to run down as well.
Okay.
I want to thank you so very much for coming on. You've been marvelous and interesting, and the stories that you tell are so fascinating and chock full of wonderful information for folks. So, you know, it's been both entertaining and very enlightening to
thank you.
To
this
your
has been
story.
A delight for me.
Yeah,
it's really
I'm
been a delight.
So glad.
Thank you. You have a good day.
Pardon?
I was just going to say you have a good day.
Well, thank you as well. If there is a way that you want folks to be able to contact you, would you like to give out that information?
Oh, sure. I can give people my email. My cell phone doesn't work, and I'm not at home right now, but.
Sure.
If they wanted to contact me, they
want to
contact me.
Your home phone number anyway. The broadcast is actually heard around the world. So.
Oh, wow. Let's just do the email. Really?
Email
oh my God,
is good.
You're amazing. You are amazing. I guess you're 27 years old with a lot of experience. Okay, the email itself is kinnucan@patriot.net, K-I-N-N-U-C-A-N, @patriot.net.
Okay, that's wonderful.
And I really do want to tell people, if they want to do something, do it, do it, do it.
Yes.
Go for it, take the risk, do it.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, that's what's really inspired you, inspired me about your story when I, you know, read the information that you sent to me. It really is about that. I'm going to march in there, and, you know, if it means that I have to hide in the coat room to get it done, I'm going to do it. I'm so very inspired, Lynn, and I'm so very grateful for having had this chance to talk with you. It's fantastic.
Thank you. It was an absolute delight.
Right.
You take care, too, okay?
You too. All right. I will talk to you later. And everyone, thank you so much for joining the show. It's been such a pleasure to talk with Lynn, and I hope that you've enjoyed the conversation as well. If you have any questions, would like to follow up, feel free to send me email at info@123untangled.com. That's info@123untangled.com. I'm also booking the fall portion of the show as well. So if you or somebody you know should be on the show, contact me about that as well, and I would love to talk with you about appearing on the show. Again, thanks so much for listening. Next week we're going to be back with my good friend Glenn, whose last name I'm blanking on. I can't believe this. He's going to kill me. I'm going to have to send you out an update to give you Glenn's last name, but this is really awful. I'm really hot in here. I think it's what it is. I've turned off the air conditioning so that it's not interfering with the sound of the show, and I'm kind of trying to talk a little bit so that I can remember his last name, but this is terrible. He's not going to let me live this down. Anyway, come back next week. We're going to be talking a little bit about the divorce mediation and about Glenn's upbringing. So we'll talk to you later, and thanks again for listening to the show. I'm going to leave you with a bit of music here, actually. As you know, I like to support independent musicians. This is a piece by an artist named Kuku, K-U-K-U. He is originally from Nigeria, and lately he has been in France. The piece is from an album called The Cure, and it's called Soldier of Peace. And Lynn, based on our conversation, I thought that it would be most appropriate to play this one. So I hope you enjoy this music, and again, have a wonderful rest of the week, everyone. Bye-bye.
Bye.
To ba jana o mi lero emi loko iya e to ba ya ju o ma je ya ko je mo ara re. Long ago I swear that I will never cry again. The only tear that will roll down this eyes are tears of joy. You can do your worst, I will only rise. Like the phoenix, I will soar. If you're fire, then I'm water. I'm your worst nightmare, your cure. If you're cancer, then I'm chemotherapy. I'm the cure. If you're bondage, then I'm freedom. If you're hatred, then I'm love. If you're cancer, then I'm chemotherapy. I'm the cure. Is in love. You can push.
Monkeys, talk to me.